103.2 Dublin City FM.
GAA Sports Desk on Dublin City FM.
With Mick Hanley, Suzanne Parker and Peter Brennigan.
In association with Tipperary Natural Mineral Water. And we start by thanking John on the Live Route Time team for getting you home safely this evening. Now, on the show this evening, we're going to be speaking to Ronnie Bellew and Dermot Crowe about their new book, Hell for Leather. And we're also going to be speaking to Tommy Conroy, the manager of St. Vincent's, as they defeated Road in the Leinster Club Football Championship final. We're also going to be speaking to Brennan Cooper, the vice chairman of Dublin Camogie. And remember, if you want to contact us on the show here, you can. The text line is 087-977-1032. You can go on our Facebook page, which is GAA Sports Desk on Dublin City FM. Or you can email us, gaasportsdesk@dublincityfm.com. But it's on a sad note that we start the show this evening. Obviously, yesterday evening, Andy Kettle passed away. And earlier on, Mick caught up with Sean Shanley, the vice chairman of Dublin GAA.
Well, Sean, Dublin County Board have been rocked with the news that the County Board chairman, Andy Kettle, sadly passed away yesterday evening after a short illness. Our condolences here to his family, friends, Fingal Ravens, the county board, and everyone. Sad day for everybody, especially his family.
Yes, indeed, Mick. Thank you very much. I wouldn't say we were shocked today. We got the bad news sort of the day before that it was imminent, you know. So, but up to that, we were hopeful. And Andy, indeed, only a couple of weeks ago at a management meeting in Parnell Park, was very hopeful that He'd managed the illness, and after treatment, you know, about six sessions, he reckoned he'd be back right as rain. And he had good hope right up to the end, indeed. Only the last day or two, the family realised how bad it was. So it is very, very sad for everyone, particularly his wife, Phyllis, and six children, three boys, three girls, well, indeed. Not children now, but always children to them.
And of course, Andy re-elected County Board Chairman at the convention on Monday night, even in his absence.
Yeah, I took the chair as Vice Chairman, and of course all nominations were in, and everything was right when Andy was in his health, and he was the only nomination for Chairman, so he was elected unopposed in his absence, and little did we know that it'd be the following day he'd pass away.
And Sean, you've been vice chair with Andy over the last number of years, and I suppose both of you looking at Dublin GAA and I suppose positive years and good years.
It was indeed. Last 4 years, Andy's been in the chair and I was vice chair. We had great times, two All-Ireland winning footballs, and of course Leinster's and back-to-back national leagues, only football leagues this year, first time. Great success, even though some people looked on the year as disappointing, you know. But it was terrific. And then, of course, the big breakthrough in hurling and winning the national league and then winning the Leinster title, you know, first time in 72 years, I think, for a league. So huge breakthrough and hopefully we'll be able to carry on and keep Dublin up there in both hurling and football.
And I suppose people probably looked at the dynamic of it. You were a hurling man, Andy was a football man, but Andy very much was to the forefront in pushing hurling, and especially the hurling out in Fingal.
Yes, indeed, yeah. There's lots of clubs in Fingal now playing hurling, whereas in the past Fingal was strictly football and football only, you know. And Hard for some people to get, you know, realise they can play hurling as well. But with the influx of new people too into all those areas in Fingal, there was people coming from hurling counties. So it has improved, and it was always encouraged. And Andy was the main man behind a Fingal team entering the leagues, and indeed got to the Nicky Rackard final last year. So great success, and he was delighted with that.
And John, as well, for Andy, he seemed to be all the tributes coming in. He was a gentleman. He was able to get the job done well in a very, very positive manner as well. And but what would you say his greatest attribute was?
Oh, he was a gentleman and got on well with everyone, and without giving in to them, he coerced them and twisted arms, but he got around them nicely and got the job done and could be very firm when he needed to be. Games were played and there was no nonsense taken, you know. Chairman get lots of requests and, you know, to call off matches sometimes for frivolous reasons, but he was also fair if it should have been called off for a debt of a committee man or that, he saw to it that it was. So I think everyone realised he was fair to everybody and no favourites.
Well, Sean, as we said, a sad day for his family, sad day for the Dublin County Board as well, Fingal Ravens, his club, and certainly for the GAA all over. He will be sadly missed.
Oh, very, very, very badly missed now. Dublin, he was on the Central Council delegate as well as being chairman, and he was elected onto the management committee in Croke Park. So he had an important job and good influence there. But I think apart from his family missing him, Fingal Ravens will miss him. You know, he's always been a great representative of Fingal Ravens, and indeed they went all the way up to Senior One, you know, and competing at the highest table from a small rural junior club. You know, Fingal Ravens have done super and have their own grounds out there now. So great tribute to Andy that he was one of the main men behind all that.
And of course he put huge amounts of time into the GAA and into his role since his retirement from the Irish Times.
He did indeed, yeah. It has been his life, I'd say, certainly for the last 4 years, everything revolved around it. So a busy man, but enjoyed it all.
And of course, Sean, that's one thing we can say about Andy, is that sad day indeed for everyone at GAA, but Andy, he left a legacy that can be worked on.
He can indeed, yeah, and hopefully we'll keep it all going in his memory.
And our thanks to Sean Shanley, the Vice Chairman of Dublin GAA, for speaking to us. Andy Kettle, in his position as Chairman of Dublin GAA since late 2010, and of course he was only reappointed on Monday evening to us. So to his wife Phyllis, his sons Patrick, Peter and Owen, his daughters Niamh, Orla and Kira, we send our sincerest condolences from everybody here on GAA Sports Desk on Dublin City FM. Now, St Vincent's defeated Roed in the Leinster Club Football Championship final on Sunday, and earlier on, Mick caught up with manager Tommy Conroy.
Yeah, thanks, Mick. No, we got a great start. I think we made a couple of goal chances early on, and you know, Tomás finished very well, and that sort of it set us up nicely. Then, you know,
indeed, I suppose you had four goal chances, I think, in the first 9 minutes of the game. Were you disappointed you didn't convert the other ones?
Well, I wouldn't say disappointed. It was great that we were making those chances. It was probably a little bit disappointing that they weren't going in. They weren't going into the net for us. But once we were making those chances, you'd have to be happy, Mick.
Indeed. And I suppose, Tommy, in many ways, the quality of ball going into the full forward line had the Offaly defence, especially the full back line in sixes and sevens.
Yeah, we worked the ball in very well. But again, I think the reason for that was the work that was being done around the middle of the park. I think we were winning a lot of breaking ball, and it was being moved quickly into the full forward line, and that was creating openings for us inside.
And I suppose, as you said, the midfielders, like both Eamon and Doughty, had an exceptional games, both of them, and keeping the two McNamees reasonably quiet for most of the game.
Yeah, we did very well in the middle of the park, and Doughty had a very good game, and Eamon as well, and you know, we were disrupting their kickouts. We were getting breaks. Gavin was picking up a lot of. Gavin Bourke was getting a lot of breaks. Shane Carty was getting a lot of breaking ball. And again, it was the way we were using that ball. You know, getting it inside to the likes of Tomás and Kieran Dorney inside.
Indeed, and you mentioned as well the quality of the ball for Tomás's goal. I think the pass that Dermot Connolly gave was sublime, Tommy. That's I think the only way you could describe it.
Yeah. You know, the ball was worked out, I think, to the stand side of the pitch, and then it was recycled back, and Dermot split the defence with a great ball into Moss, and the only way Mossy can, I mean, he's incredible finisher, and he tucked the ball away very nicely.
1-5-2, I think, at half time. Many people in the stands or in the crowd saying that perhaps you should have been further ahead, but you certainly came out in the second half, despite the fact that Roe did put up some resistance and just clipped off the scores.
Yeah. Well, what the lads had discussed inside at half time, and it worked very well for them, was that we were very conscious of just trying to keep the scoreboard ticking over. We knew Road would come at us in the second half, which they did, and we dealt with that quite well. And when we did get the ball down the other end of the pitch, we kicked some very good points, which again, you know, kept that momentum going for us, Mick.
Indeed, yeah. We mentioned, of course, the midfield and the forwards, but without a resolute defence in your team, they done very well indeed when the ball did come in. And I suppose for many ways, Niall McNamee had a frustrating day for such a top-class player.
Yeah. Well, it was where he was even getting the ball. It wasn't sort of directly in front of the goal. And again, that's great credit to the work that was being done further out the pitch. And inside Jarlett, and you know, Jarlett Curley and Hugh Gill were very, you know, they were very patient and they were very good at working the inside men and not being, you know, diving in and giving away any silly frees. They were very disciplined in that manner. And I thought Jer Brennan can, he was very good at talking to lads and just keeping that set up very, very disciplined for us in our back line.
Yeah, I didn't hang around afterwards, Tommy. I think I was back in Dublin probably before you were having the showers, as they say. But I know Jer did make a comment that kind of he's looking forward to resuming his Dublin career as well. And kind of looking at the displays that he's had this year, very, very solid at centre-back and marshals the troops well.
Yeah, Jer, very, very experienced player now. He's been around a long time, and we've other players there that are getting a lot of experience, and the communication amongst them is very, very good. And Jer has been excellent at talking to people and just keeping them focused when we need them focused.
And Tommy, again, you put out the same 15. I think this must be a record, is it? I don't know how many games it is now. I've lost count, but it must be a great position to be in.
Well, again, Mick, I'd make the point we've a very, very, very strong panel, and we have, you know, it's not just the 15 that are starting, it's the other lads. And but what's really very, very important for us is the quality of our training and the intensity of our training, and that is helped by everybody that's involved. And, you know, we're always, at some stage a decision might be made where, you know, we just can't help but go with somebody else. But at the moment, it's, you know, we still have very serious discussions about who we're going to pick. It's not just rolled out the same 15, but they're doing the job, and I don't know whether it'll be the same 15 the next day.
Well, different game, and of course you're playing Carrofin, the Galway champions and Connacht champions in that semi-final. A lot of people making a lot of Carrofin at the moment, too. They've had an excellent season. I suppose they've beaten some very good sides along the way, Tommy, too. Oh, and I suppose one thing that comes out is that they're supposed to be a very, very good footballing side.
Yeah, I made a comment on Sunday that I have. There's a friend of mine over in Galway has been telling me very early in the year to watch out for Carrofin. And I had said to him, listen, I'd be delighted to meet Carrofin at any stage. And it's happened now. But by all accounts, they are an extremely skillful side. They're a very good footballing side. And they have taken care of some very, very, you know, good quality opposition, not only within their own county, but also in Connacht.
What's the plan for yourselves? I suppose Christmas is coming up, only a week or so away at this stage. What's the plan for the lads or for training?
Well, I think the plan for them is to enjoy this. They've had a long year. You know, they've won Dublin and now they've won Leinster, and you know, they need now to enjoy that and get a rest and get a break from each other and the routine, and to go off and enjoy their families now and home life and enjoy their Christmas. And we'll get back together in the new year and hopefully be rejuvenated and refreshed and looking forward to Carrofin. And again, I think, you know, a lot of people are talking about this, and please God, it's a great matchup, and it's two very good footballing teams, and we'll have nothing but the height of respect for Cora Finn and what they've achieved.
Freshness is important to you, Tommy, too. I think that you gave the lads a few days off after the Gary Castle game, too, and it kind of showed last Sunday.
Well, it's very hard to keep, you know, going, putting your boots on, going down, training, and it actually can be, as much as you want, you're delighted that you're going down, and at this time of the year, it can become monotonous and it can be wearing, and it is very important that you get away from each other for a while and that you do come back sort of with a bit of hunger and appetite for it. And hopefully we've got that mix right and hopefully we'll get it right in the new year.
Well, you've got the mix right so far, Tommy. Many, many congratulations again. We look forward to that game against Cora Finn sometime in late February. And I suppose a happy Christmas and a happy new year to yourself and everyone at St. Vincent's.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Mick.
Tommy.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Yeah.
And our congratulations to Tommy Conroy, the manager of St. Vincent's, the first club in Leinster to get back-to-back provincial titles since Air Og all the way back in 95-96. That's Air Og of Carlow. So fantastic form for Tommy Conroy and the lads. And hopefully they can go on and put back-to-back All-Irelands together, which would be an absolutely huge achievement. Now, Ronnie Bellew and Dermot Crowe, two journalists with the Irish Independent, have recently released a book, Hell for Leather, A Journey Through Hurling in 100 Games. And earlier on this evening, Mick caught up with Dermot Crowe to discuss the book.
Well, Dermot, many congratulations to yourself and Ronnie on your new book, Hell for Leather, A Journey Through Hurling in 100 Games. And I suppose there's been a lot of hurling games over that period of time, but some fascinating ones, probably some great games, some bad games, but I think you capture it all in the book. You start off with the Easter Rising, the 1887 All-Ireland between Tipperary and Galway, and of course you go up to 2013 with that famous replay, Champagne Hurling between Clare and Cork. And looking at the two games, what a contrast in scores.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Like the first All-Ireland make, you know, the score was 1-1 to no score, you know, and you know, in the early years, scoring was quite low, and it sort of gradually starts to increase. Then, so I mean, the game has changed, of course, a great deal since that particular first All Ireland, which was played in 1887 between Tip and Galway, and played in Bor. I think the crowd of about 5,000 were at it, and one of the Galway players, John Lowry, actually walked 20 miles. From Galway to Bor to make the game, because he arrived at the wrong rendezvous and missed the lift to the match. Now, despite the fact that he walked, he still made the game on time, because the Tipperary party were also delayed by a couple of hours because they had a row over expenses on the platform, you know. So Tipperary won the game, and so it began, you know, the first All-Ireland and all the ones we've had since then. And of course, the game now has changed in so many ways from that time, you know, in terms of the popular appeal, the crowds, it's modernised. Also, the actual numbers playing, at that time, make you a 21-a-side, you know, you'd larger playing area, a more physical kind of a game, and a lot of wrestling and more chaotic kind of. And then gradually over the period of time, over the decades, it sort of became more refined with rule changes and lower numbers. In 1892, they reduced it to 17 players. In 1913, it went down to 15, what we have now. And so, yes, massive changes over that period of time. And I suppose that's what the book is trying to kind of convey, those changes and the way the game has evolved using the framework of the 100 games, you know.
It's fascinating the way you said that, Dermot, that the Tipperary team are late because there was a bit of a row over expenses on the platform.
Yeah.
And people kind of look back to the formation of the GPA. It obviously happened a long, long time ago.
Well, this problem was there. I would say money's the source of all evil, but you know what I mean? And so, yes, it's kind of funny when you think about it, and you think the GPA and this player. Now, of course, player issues were, you know, certainly I remember back in the 1970s, John Callan of Clare was involved in the players' group that tried to get somewhere with other players and meet the GA, but they were kind of, as he said, they were killed by kindness, they were bought on board, and they were suddenly, what was their idea became a GA idea, and they were kind of subsumed into the overall GA idea, and the thing just kind of died to death. But that's relatively recently. This is way back, of course. a couple of centuries ago. So it is a bit of a surprise. And there's a few things you'd notice, actually, in doing this book, where history repeats itself a bit like that. You know, like even over the concern you'd have about Hurling, Mick, you know, where, if you remember 20 years ago, Nicky Brennan making these very dire forecasts about Hurling's future. At the time, and of course the next year Clare won the First All Ireland in 81 years, and you had the start of a Hurling revolution with new winners and all that. The traditional counties had to take a back seat for a few years, and yet only a short time before that Nicky was looking very kind of grim and not very optimistic about the way that Hurling was going, you know. And these kind of concerns aren't new, you know, they occur right throughout the timeline. And like one of the games in the book is 34 All Ireland final between Limerick and Dublin, and in that particular game, or leading into that particular year, Carberry, who was a famous chronicler of the games and seen a lot of All-Irelands and played in a couple himself, looked very sort of a bit like Nicky, and so many years later was very sort of pessimistic about the way Hurling was going. He thought that it wasn't a physical game, you know, with all these manly figures that they had previously, and that was becoming really too dainty. And he said that he was worried that it was now catering for a diminutive race of men, you know. And James E. Kelleher, the famous Cork hurler, also, you know, had his reservations. He described the hurlers of the 30s very dismissively as hair oil hurlers, you know. And yet this is the 30s when you imagine that hurling was tough, you know, and you'd like to make Mahi marauding around the place. So all these things kind of reoccur, and it's interesting. You'd be surprised how early some of these ideas started to form, you know.
In the Dublin side, Dermot, and you just mentioned there, of course, one of the chapters is Blue Heaven, which is Dublin winning that Leinster title against Galway, 225-213 in 2013. But in 2011, in the National League final, Dublin had a big victory over Kilkenny, and I suppose there have been many new dawns in Dublin hurling. There's been a lot of work put in it over the years, and, you know, a lot of people getting behind Dublin hurling going back. We had, I suppose, the Lara Foley era when there was the nearly beaten Kilkenny in a couple of Leinster finals and all that. But this team and this era kind of for Dublin has been probably the strongest it's ever been.
It has, in a sense, because, you know, Dublin have won six All-Irelands, you know, but there's only one native Dubliner, Jim Bourne, in 1938, who actually won an All-Ireland medal, you know. And we'll say, if you look at, this, you know, well, I know that obviously the recent teams had a few guys coming in, like Ryan O'Dwyer, Tipperary, player Niall Corcoran from Galway and all that, but on the you know, for the most part, they're a homegrown team, essentially. Now, so in the early years, the Dublin teams were made up of you know, people from the country who worked, a lot of them in the bar trade and that, you know. And so, you know, they didn't really kind of go out on the road. The game itself became, you know, kind of a secondary or a poor relation to football. You know, it's been like that for most of, I suppose, it's been like that right through, really. And but something happened. Then they decided to sort of try and, they, in 1928, they launched a kind of a citywide primary schools and colleges hurling league. And by the time you got to the 48 All-Ireland, when they lost to Waterford, you had something, I think it's sort of six players from Dublin who were kind of homegrown on that team, you know. So they were starting to make some progress in that respect, you know. By the time it got to 61 then, and that famous All-Ireland that they still talk about, because they played Tipperary and only lost by a point and felt they should have won. By that time, all but one of the team were Dublin natives, and the exception being Paddy Croke of Killinall, Tipperary, and I think Mick Kennedy was on the subs from Fawkes, who went to play with Fawkes and Tipperary originally as well. But that particular team and that particular final, Tipperary won everything in sight that year, Mick, and this is the closest they came to lose a game. You know, they won the league, they won everything, they swept the boards, and that they went on to become the team of the decade, one of the best teams of all time. Powerful team, you know, very strong way throughout the field, but they went into that final with a few injuries. Kieran Carey and Tony Wall, Jimmy Doyle had painkilling injections going into the match, and so it was an opportunity for Dublin, certainly. And they played very well. They were down 4 points at half time. They got a goal from Willie Jackson early in the second half, and then there were 2 points up, I think, with 12 minutes to go. And Achill Bootman, one of the two Bootman brothers from Crumlin, was in fantastic form. He scored 5 points on playoff. John Doyle gave him the run around. And Dublin's movement and speed really, really had Tipperary in bother. But they dug it out, you know, and a big turning point, I suppose, was the sending off of Lara Foley, you know, where he got involved in an incident where he wasn't directly involved initially and he just got involved in it, if you know what I mean. The Tipperary player was going to be sent off anyway, I think. The referee was dealing with it. So that was a big blow because they were defending very well and Lara was a big loss to them. So as a result of that, of course, they never kicked on. That year, in 61, they had, just to show you how strong they were, they had 8 players in the Railway Cup team that won the Railway Cup final against Munster. But it never developed from there, unfortunately. And they went a long time then without even contesting a Leinster final from 64 to 1990 before Lara came back as manager, brought them to a few Leinster finals. And then, of course, the recent years, which I would agree with you, were probably the more successful years and the most interesting ones because, that was a great championship win in 2013 now in Leinster. And beating Kilkenny, of course, famously in a replay in the semi-final, their first championship win over them since 1942. And as you know, it's not easy to beat Kilkenny, let alone in a replay.
103.2 Dublin City FM, real radio for Dublin.
True enough. For Dublin and the new counties as well, Dermot, because as you mentioned, you know, Kilkenny, Cork and Tipperary really have ruled the roost if you go back over the last 100 years or more. In Hurling. Where do you see the progression from them, or can you see the breakthrough of the likes of the Dublins, the Waterfords, the Leashes, even Clare winning 2 All-Irelands, you know, coming through? Because they're very strong under 21 players as well.
I think you can. I think what you've seen certain breakthroughs at kind of underage level. You've certainly seen gradually in Dublin, for example, an improvement, a more steady improvement in underage where they've become a lot more competitive. And I remember back in 2005, I think it was in Casement Park when I heard the result that the minors had beaten Dublin and in the championship, and they went on, of course, to win the Leinster final against Wexford. I remember thinking, my God, that's an incredible result, and it's a big, big result for Dublin to beat Kilkenny at minor level. It's not such a surprise anymore. Now, what they need, of course, to do, and they've come close in recent years, is to win All-Ireland at underage level and build on that, and then gradually you would hope that, you know, that they would sort of become, develop a good senior team in years to come. And I do think as well in Dublin that the county board, in fairness to them, whereas previous years, maybe I'm going back some time, there might have been a certain amount of lip service paid to it. I think they're genuine in supporting and developing hurling. I think that's very important. And I think there's a lot more people buying into it now and a lot more people are out playing hurling on the streets and there's a lot more kids playing it and all that. So I think that can only be good. And with Dublin's population and resources and stuff like that, there's no reason why they can't go on and really challenge for All-Ireland in the year ahead. They have an excellent manager now in Ger Cunningham. I think there's a fellow now who is very eager, very experienced and eager to make his mark. And I think that's a good meeting of the two there, a good marriage. And other counties as well, Waterford, you know, they won an All-Ireland minor title after a long, long lapse. And Limerick have made a kind of a drive as well and coming out of, and very unlucky this year not to to beat Kilkenny in the semi-final of the Ireland. You can see what Clare are doing, particularly with 3 All-Ireland, you know, with, you know, lots of success at underage level, particularly at under 21 level, you know, and the type of hurling they're playing as well has changed dramatically from the type of hurling that won them All-Irelands in the 90s. You know, it's a much more skill-based technical game. So I think there's lots of promising signs and green shoots. Obviously, there's some areas like Offaly where they're struggling, and they're trying to address that now, and we'll say Leash certainly have shown great improvement and are playing a lovely style of hurling now as well and going about it the right way. They were in serious bother a few years ago, so there's good signs. But what you see as well, Mick, is that the traditional counties won't just step aside. You know, they will continue to give it everything as well, so that challenge won't cease. But it's up to each county themselves to try and do the best they can and try to come. But I think it's more, there's more of a prospect of it now if some of those counties kind of making more of a challenge. The issue then is to kind of try and see if you can develop the game beyond that again into the next layer, into the next zone, if you like, you know, or you for the likes of Kildare's and those kind of counties, you know, Westmeath, Carlow, can you develop the game there where it's going to become, they can become a serious championship team. you know, and then further down, can you develop the game in Mayo? Can you develop it in Kerry? Can you develop it in Donegal? You know, and to bring it up a few levels and really, you know, have a presence there, because this is the odd thing, and it hasn't changed in some ways at all over the course of this history, which the book covers, that it is still the preserve really of three counties to a great extent, and even though we have this magnificent game in some places in the country, it's a slightly exotic game or almost an alien game. And I know that's changed to a great extent, but it still needs, that work still has to be done. You know, I think there, in some way we've failed the game by not spreading it to a wider audience. And I mean, what I mean by a wider audience, I mean a participatory audience. And, you know, it's a shame, I think, that any young fella in Ireland wouldn't get the chance to try his hand at hurling. And he may not like it, because anyone who's played it understands the trail of it, you know, and the fix you get from playing it, there's nothing like it, you know. And I know maybe everybody doesn't share that view, but I mean, I think they all would appreciate the skill levels of it and the fantastic speed of it, and hurling played well is a fantastic game. So I think that's the challenge of the next 100 years, mate, long after we're gone. And hopefully they've seen the light now, and they can spread that, and they can continue to spread. And Dublin, of course, should be at the forefront of that. And we hope to do. And we would love to see them coming through and win All Ireland. I mean, that would be. I mean, what we saw with them winning the Leinster Championship and the emotion that went with that, and the league final, those were great days. They really were. And the hurling they played was good as you'll see. And I think that was the great thing about it. As much the way they played and they won it those 2 days, as the actual winning of it, you know, they went out and they went for it, and they played a great brand of hurling. So it shows you what they can do, and they don't have to doff the cap to anybody really. And hopefully now they can build on the legacy of Anthony Daly and the standard set and take it on to the next level.
True enough, yeah. And I suppose one of the driving forces at county board level was a football man from North County Dublin, Dublin County Board Chairman Andy Kettle. Andy was very much instrumental in pushing the hurling and pushing Fingal hurling as well. But Dermot, sadly, Andy passed away last night, having been re-elected on Monday night at the Dublin Convention. He'd be a huge loss to Dublin GAA and to the GAA as a whole.
Yes, I mean, obviously, first of all, foremost, his family, a huge loss to his family, and I'd like to extend my own condolences to them. And from my own experience of talking to Andy and all that, he was very, very helpful. I think most of the reaction that you've seen so far, there's one word that keeps coming up, and it's that he was a gentleman, you know. And I think, you know, he was a very open and enthusiastic, open-minded and enthusiastic administrator. And I think he was a very progressive man. And I think he was a good man, and I think he'll be greatly missed. And he was, you know, hurling or football, I don't think he really had a favourite. I think he was a very kind of, he had a very evangelical kind of spirit, and I think he was a great PR man, you know, for Dublin, and a very popular guy. And I don't think anyone's a bad word to say about him. And you know, it's a good thing, I suppose, he had some happy days with Dublin, particularly in recent years, in hurling and football, and he played a significant role in making those days possible. So, you know, it's a sad day for his family and Fingal Ravens, yes, and North County, I suppose, but he leaves behind a very good legacy, and I think people had a lot of love for him.
Indeed, Andy. Indeed, Dermot. Dermot, just a final question I want to ask you. This is more to do with, from an author's point of view. Ronnie and yourself, both, Ronnie, yeah, Bellio and yourself wrote this book. How difficult is it for two people to sit down and write a book together? Or what way did you do the book?
Nice. Good question, Mick. First of all, I suppose Ronnie and I know one another, I suppose, for about 25 years or so, you know, and we're from Galway, and met in college, and we've had a friendship since then and an interest in hurling since then, and we would have had conversations over the years and all that. And the kind of, I suppose, in the last few years the idea started to form. Two people make, because it would be a massive undertaking for one person to do it, you know, almost impossible in a sense, or too forbidding if you wanted to do 100 games. So I think that was on a practical level, that was the idea there. In terms of the breakup, we just tried to sort of, first of all, decide what games we were going to do. And we didn't want to do. We had agreed we didn't want to do just 100 great games or 100 epic games or 100 All-Irelands, or, you know, and we'll try to mix it a bit, so that, of course, you will have a lot of the obvious games, the great games as well, but we want to bring in maybe the first club finals there. There's an under-21 hurling final, a classic game, which was out in 1989 in Portlaoise between Offaly and Tipperary, which is trying to represent that particular competition, under-21 hurling, which has produced fantastic games over the years, you know. So we decided on, we had to decide a list of games and kind of at regular intervals over the course of time, and which would in some way, it wasn't just about the matches themselves in terms of the specific details of the game, but as much about the context in which they were played and maybe events around them, you know, make like maybe particular rule changes may have impacted them at that time, you know, or in the early years it could be just the pure sense of instability around, you know, the kind of nationalism that was there and factions and people. Like the very first All-Ireland, Pat Madden was from Meelick in Galway. He was the Galway captain 6 months after that first All-Ireland, they lost to Tipperary. He was evicted from his home, you know, so these kind of things were happening around it. So we tried to bring all those kind of layers into it where we could, and we did a fair bit of research in it. We felt we tried to bring stuff that's reasonably original into it as much as possible, and then we did a lot of interviews, and we took and interviewed people up to 40, I think, to try and bring in kind of fresh materials as far as we could, you know, to games. Obviously with interviews we talk about more recent vintage and that, but so I suppose we kind of, you know, they, I wouldn't say the games picked themselves, but I mean we had no great rows over which ones went in or anything like that, and we were happy enough, you know what I mean, with what we I'm sure there's some games maybe could have gone in and some could have been left out maybe, but that was more or less, you know, we kind of had a, we worked together then from there on, and we tried to sort of keep it reasonably coherent in terms of the way it kind of was told, but each one is kind of a story in itself, you know, and I suppose they're like steps in the journey as you go along. And I was just trying to give people an idea of what this game was like initially and how it came from and what it changed and what shaped it, the type of people who played it, the attitudes around it, how the tradition was formed, how it developed, you know, how some counties broke through, how they went into long periods of isolation and not winning anything for years and decades sometimes, you know, and try to maybe get a grasp of that. And I suppose I would hope maybe that people don't have to be an absolute hurling genius or philosopher or professor or expert to enjoy the book, you know, the people who maybe come recently to it or have started to take an interest in hurling relatively recently, maybe because it's become so popular, could also dip into it and maybe find out a bit more and learn a bit more about it, you know. And it's not trying to portray itself as a definitive history of hurling or anything like that, you know, that was beyond the bounds of the scope of this book, and it's not what we wanted to achieve, you know, but just to give a flavour of how the game has developed and changed and why it's become so popular, I suppose, and why it's the game it is today.
Our listeners, it's Hell for Leather, a journey through hurling in 100 games by Ronnie Bellew and Dermot Crowe. Dermot, many, many thanks for talking with us on the programme, and we wish you every success with the book and with hurling. We look forward to many, many more games for as long as we can see them.
Mick, thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it. And happy Christmas to you and your listeners. We'll talk again.
And our thanks to Dermot Crowe for speaking to us. And just a reminder, that book, Hell for Leather, A Journey Through Hurling in 100 Games, written by Ronnie Bellew and Dermot Crowe, is available in all good bookshops ahead of Christmas, which is, of course, just over a week away. Now, recently, Suzanne caught up with the Vice Chairman of Dublin Camogie, Brendan Cooper, and they looked back on the year that was 2014.
And I am delighted to be joined by the Vice Chairman of Dublin Camogie, Brendan Cooper. Brendan, thank you very much for joining me on the programme. Well, look, it's the end of the year and we're going to have a look back at the year of 2014 in Dublin Camogie, and maybe first we'll have a look at the senior championship and what it was. Tough game for the girls, or a tough year for the Dublin Camogie team.
So then it's in the senior league, we actually got Cork, Wexford and Tipperary. All those three counties there are particularly strong, Suzanne.
Yeah.
And we were unfortunate to draw each of those. And it wasn't a great league campaign. We managed to get a draw against Tipperary, but perhaps we should have won that particular match on the day. Tipperary had two goals towards the end, and that kind of got them back in the game. But the games against Wexford and Cork were, let's you say, that we were a little bit over depth, Suzanne, and that showed greatly on the day itself. But, I mean, we fulfilled all the fixtures and from that point of view. So, as I think I mentioned earlier, it's a kind of a transitional period at the moment for Dublin Camogie. Unfortunately, that sort of a league probably wasn't a great advertiser for Dublin Camogie, but I think we've kind of corrected that situation now at this stage, Suzanne. But it was a baptism of fire for the girls, to say the least.
Yeah, and Colm King came in, I think the first competitive game with the girls was in March with this Wexford game in the league.
Again, Suzanne, you know, you're taking on the All-Ireland champion in the first match.
Yeah.
So Flynn from Colm, it was a baptism of fire. And again, we wouldn't have even had a chance to kind of regroup at that stage, because that was one of our very first matches we played in around the middle of February, the third week of February of last year, Suzanne. So we came in cold, coming up against the All-Ireland champions. It didn't work out too well that day, let's just put it that way.
Yeah, and then looking at the senior championship, they were in, it was another tough group with Cork, Wexford and Galway.
If the league was a tough one, Suzanne, the championship was from God. It went from bad to worse. Now we could not have got a worse draw if we picked out the counties out of the hand ourselves. It was, you know, Cork, obviously, they've been the All-Ireland for the last number of years. Galway are All-Ireland winners. Wexford were current All-Ireland winners. So it really was, you know, it was really, really tough for the girls. And again, that showed, I think, the league campaign having not done so well coming into a championship didn't argue well from a confidence point of view from the girls. And I think we possibly just went through the motions, although that wouldn't have been our intention, Suzanne, but certainly we were up it right from the word go, and the matches were all one way, you know, to say the least. And we were glad when the campaign was over, because at least we could regroup and look at you know, what we would need to do to kind of rectify the situation. But I think we'll talk about that later on anyway.
And moving on then to the Premier Juniors, they had some successes this year.
That's right, Suzanne. This is a team who had won a Junior All-Ireland the previous year, and we had high hopes that they would, you know, kind of add the Premier Junior Championship to their existing championship. And they started off really well. We led the group, the group stages. We were, I think, there were six teams involved, and we won our first three matches, so we were riding high. And then all of a sudden we went up to down and won the group matches, and we were beaten. Not the end of the world, but things seemed to go a little bit downhill from there at that stage, to the extent that we were actually fighting for one of the last places in All-Ireland semi-final, which we duly got. But unfortunately, we came up against Leash, and we'd well beaten earlier in the year in the league final. And we ended up getting beaten by about 7 or 8 points, which was a bit of a shock to the system, considering we'd already beaten Leash earlier in the year. But again, sometimes teams, it goes that way, and you know, a team that's riding high all of a sudden gets a reverse, and things just go a little bit downhill from there. So it was a little bit disappointing from the Premier Juniors' perspective. I think they expected to win an All-Ireland Championship. It didn't work out, Suzanne, but as I say, that's not to say that this year they won't kind of rectify last year's performance and go on to bigger and better things.
Yeah.
We have high hopes for that Premier Junior side. It's a well-established side at this stage, and 2015 hopefully will, you know, bring the All-Ireland that they missed out on this year.
And we spoke a few times during the year just about these Premier Juniors. They had such a successful start to this campaign, and then when it came to the stage of not having to fight for their place anymore, when the place was secured in the semi-final, they almost seemed to not get complacent, yeah, but there wasn't the same urge and pushing them forward.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that, Suzanne, because, I mean, really, it had gone all too easy. They actually had far too easy. They were, yeah, they won their matches, and maybe a little bit of complacency set in. It's, okay, we only have to go through the motions, but unfortunately, in games, that's not the case. And I imagine that's probably the primary reason that we didn't go on to success, that we maybe got a little bit overconfident. It's something that we could say, look at going forward to next year, that there's no such thing as a surefire victory.
Yeah.
You're going to have to win. You're going to have to play to your potential to win all these matches. And anything less than a 100% commitment, obviously, leads to kind of defeats. And that's exactly what we had last year. It wasn't a bad year, Suzanne, but it wasn't as good a year as we possibly had hoped at the start of the year. But next year, 2015, I think we'll rectify that with a bit of luck.
Exactly. Well, looking at the minor championship, they had some ups and downs as well this year.
Yeah, again, that team came in with high hopes of doing very, very well in this particular competition. And we got off to a great start. I think we beat Cork 110-106 out there in Parnells. And we beat Galway. Then we had a reverse against Offaly, but not the end of the world. But then again, we had a reverse against Limerick as well. So, again, similar to the Premier Juniors, a great start. And then things didn't kind of materialise the way we had hoped. And from going from being, front runners in that particular competition, we were holding on by our fingernails. And eventually we got beaten in a playoff. It was actually goal difference, if I'm not mistaken. And that knocked us out of the All-Ireland Championship. And that was a bitter pill because this team had been doing really, really well. A lot of good players coming through the ranks there. And we genuinely felt that this team was going to go all the way. Again, I saw the old adage that never count your chickens there, Suzanne. And that's exactly the way the minors worked out this year. It's not the end of the world because we know we have the likes of Orla Beig and Niamh Byrne and a few others like that who are, just coming out of their minor stages this year. And they're going to make it to super adult players. And it's, again, if we look at our adult performances, we need to improve from the top and work it all the way back down to our Premier Juniors, our junior side, and our juvenile side. So, disappointing, Suzanne, yes, absolutely. But we look forward to this year's minor team, and they're back out in operation now in trials this coming Sunday. And so it's back into swing of things straight away, and hopefully bigger and better things to come in 2015. It won't lack for the want of tries, Suzanne, on our part of that, there's no doubt.
Exactly. Well, also during the summer, you had a very successful Summer Cup happening.
That's right. This is for clubs or for teams who do not have any inter-county girls on their panels. Mm. It's a way of keeping the girls ticking over throughout the summer months, because obviously when the girls are playing inter-county, whether it be senior, premier, junior or whatever, they're not really available to their clubs, and it's not right that the ordinary club player would go through the months of maybe June, July, August without any competitive games.
Yeah.
So we run off a competition specifically for the non, and it's not open to inter-county players. And this brings all the teams back into a kind of an even Steven service scenario. Teams that might have been weak in a league, when they go up against teams without, the opposite inter-county players, it brings things back down to more of a playing level. And it's a genuinely very enjoyable competition, Suzanne. And it's what we call our bread and butter competitions. We absolutely need them. Without them, the girls would probably be going off playing whatever it is, hockey or water polo, whatever it is they play these days. And we like to keep them taking over. And they have some meaning competitive matches. And they're very fought. They're very hard fought, Suzanne. And they're taken as a really championship style fair altogether. So, no, it's a great competition, and the girls seem to enjoy it really, really well.
Fantastic. And during, I think it was May, the Gael Lynn took place, and there were six Dublin girls nominated on the Leinster team, which is great.
That's right, yeah. Again, from a confidence point of view, because obviously we've had a bad run in the league, and again, we're not as bad as the results seem to make us out. And the fact that the mentors of the Galen chose six girls from Dublin was a kind of a more true reflection of our standard at this moment in time. And they played, I think it was Munster in the semi-final, and eventually they actually won it outright. And for those six girls representing Leinster, it's a huge thing for these girls.
Yeah.
It says thanks very much indeed for your involvement with your province, with your county, and they're deemed good enough to play with the province. So that puts a little bit of extra step into these girls, like Louise O'Hara, who has been there at the coalface for 10, 12 years, and never actually won anything. Well, that's not quite. In 2006, 2007, she won an All-Ireland Junior Championship. But since then, the victories have been few and far between. So the girls like Louise, it's a nice testament to their ability and a reward for their durability throughout all these years. So we were delighted that these girls had a kind of a nomination for our Leinster team. Mm. And it was a fabulous competition.
Yeah.
And they really enjoyed the fair. And from a confidence point of view, it made a world of a difference to them.
Exactly. Well, we also had some other successes and Dublin players being recognised, I think, with Steph Carthy in the Puck Father competition.
That's right. Steph is she makes this competition her own. She has done with Dublin for the last number of years. She obviously plays and goals for Naismith and Oak, which is our club team. And Steph has one of these uncanny abilities to hit a ball almost as far as her male counterparts. She mm-hmm. has a wonderful strike of a ball, and she's made this Dublin footballer her basically her own for the last 4 or 5 years. Last year, I think what she was looking for was to the Cooley Mountains and representing Dublin in the All Ireland. But I think it was an injury she got to her foot, and that took her out of the competition. This year, she actually won Dublin again. Went back down to Cooley Mountains, only for the competition to be called off due to the weather. I think it was fog or a combination of rain and hail, whatever it was actually called off. So that is trace back down the following week. But again, she finished third or fourth, I think it was. But again, it's a great competition. She loves playing it, and there's a lot of players out there who make this competition their own from the various counties around Ireland. I think Miss Jackman from Wicklow, this is probably her seventh success in this competition. So she's certainly made it her own, and Stephanie has made the Dublin competition equally her own, that's for sure.
Exactly. Well, Dee Johnson also has success being nominated for and winning a Soaring Star.
That's right, Dee Johnson, one of these up-and-coming players. This is Soaring Star. This is these nominations are for girls who, in the opinion of the various provinces, have done a huge amount to kind of promote the game and who are actually kind of developing at a fast rate of knots. Girls that have potential to go on the bigger and better things. Deirdre was centre half back with our Premier Juniors. She is a real athlete. She hails from Dinsis in Marino, and she has done really well. She's a young girl, 19, 20 years of age. And again, we have high hopes that Deirdre Johnson will, I think, if memory serves it correctly, she's actually on our senior panel at the moment after last week's trials. So again, she was with our Premier Juniors. We see that she would fill a vital role for our seniors next year, and again it's a progression, Suzanne. It's just a step on the ladder, and I think it's the kind of future of Dublin Camogie, and we're hoping that she will go on to a lot bigger and better things in the years to come.
Exactly. Well, in June there were celebrations for Camogie being 110 years old. What happened during this?
Yeah, that was 110 years old. It's a milestone from no matter what association you hail from. Lots of celebrations going on, and I know the team of the century was picked by Crow Park. And again, Louisa Harris, we seem to mention Louisa Harris name week in, week out, but she's that type of person. No matter what's going, her name will always be associated. She's a wholehearted player, and again, she was named on the team of the century, which again, from a Dublin perspective, was a huge thing, because when you consider all the amount of players like Cork and Wexford and whatever, again, to have Louise's name mentioned in that sort of context was a huge thing for Louise, and a fitting tribute to her longevity and her skills, at least. And lots of celebrations there, Suzanne, and I'd say June was a particularly joyous occasion for Dublin Camogie.
And Louise O'Hara was also the winner of the Player of the Decade for Dublin.
Yes, again, she's just an unbelievable character. I mean, a lot of people now, if she's gone through the last, say, maybe 8-9 years of not winning too many matches, they would have thrown the hat a long, long time ago. Louise is first up, she's first to train, she's last to leave. She has just this unbelievable commitment to Dublin Camogie. And it's, you know, not just in the good times, and obviously she won two All-Irelands back in 2006 and 2007, but since then, nothing, absolutely nothing. And for her to come out year after year and to kind of lead by example, that's the sort of player that she is. That's why she's honoured so much, and that's why she's mentioned so much when we talk about Dublin Camogie, because she is, she emphasises everything that is good with Dublin Camogie. So a few more Louise O'Hara's wouldn't go astray, Suzanne.
And our thanks indeed to Brendan Cooper for speaking to us. That interview recorded a couple of weeks ago now. I had to cut it slightly short, but hopefully we will get to play it in full over the Christmas break. Now, if you are looking for some GAA action over the Christmas period, remember that on Sunday, December the 28th, the AIG Ladies Football Dubstars team will take on Greg McGonagall's Dublin Senior Lady team at midday out in the Parnells ground in Coolock. And also on that day, the Camogie Dubstars game will be held at the all-weather pitch in Parnells, and that's on at 12:45. So a tiny bit of a clash going on there, but well worth going out for a day of action. And also then, The traditional Dubstars game is taking place with the Dublin Bus Herald. Dubstars game is taking place on New Year's Day, also out in the Parnell's GAA Club. Jared Cunningham will have his first game in charge of the Dubs as they take on that Dubstars selection. The hurling is at 12:30 and the football is set to follow. So there's two great days of GAA action out in Parnell's Club, out just off the Malahide Road there in Coolock. But I'm afraid that is all we have time for on the GAA Sports Desk this evening. Remember that the Sporting Choice with Keno Callaghan will be on tomorrow evening at 7. And stay tuned for a purest art beat tonight. It's a solo show with Des Fitzgerald for all the latest in Dublin culture. But as this is the last show of GAA Sports Desk for 2014, I'd like to thank all of our listeners and contributors throughout the year. And from the GAA Sports Desk team for 2014, Mick Hanley, Suzanne Parker, Katie Scannell on sound, and myself, Peter Brannigan, have a happy Christmas and a very prosperous new year.